Chapter 19, Not Just a Golden Age. Throughout this book, we've been trying to discover whether the 2012 prophecies of a golden age are genuine. And we've come up with a very clear case for DNA and consciousness evolution, as well as the possibility that some sort of dimensional shift may be going on as well. So let's finish our quest to understand the legends of a golden age. If we want to know how the tradition got started in Western culture, we need to go back to the oldest literature in the Western world that described it, the classical literature of Greek and Roman times, and search for clues to reveal the even more archaic roots of these golden age prophecies. In 1952, H.C. Baldry wrote Who Invented the Golden Age? For the Classical Quarterly Journal, a truly heavy-duty piece of scholarship, showing complete fluency in multiple languages, often without even offering any translations. You have to be a major scholar to get through this paper without the help of a translator, including the ability to read the Greek alphabet and language. Amid all this intellectual chest-thumping, Baldry gives a remarkably thorough analysis of how the idea of a golden age came into being. There are many passages in ancient literature which depict an imaginary existence different from the hardships of real life, an existence blessed with nature's bounty, untroubled by strife or want. Naturally, this happy state is always placed somewhere or sometime outside normal human experience, whether off the map in some remote quarter of the world, or in Elysium after death, or in the dim future or the distant past. Such an imaginary time of bliss in the past or the future has become known as the Golden Age. We know that one, the picture of a happy existence remote from ordinary life came from sources earlier than any extant classical literature. Two, this traditional picture was normally known in antiquity before the Roman Empire as the age of Chronos, time, or Saturnus. And three, gold and the use of gold had no place in the traditional picture. When first mentioned in Hesiod's Works and Days, 42 through 46, it is not explained, but briefly alluded to as the state which men would now enjoy if the gods had not hidden the means of life from them. Hesiod is believed to have lived around 800 BC, and this is a particularly fascinating quote. It implies that we, as humans, once lived in a state that was far better than what we experience now. Baldry's research is implying that during the Golden Age, the age of time, we experience a state of being that has now been hidden from us by the gods. Bear in mind that since this is a mythological retelling of ancient information, in this case, the gods may represent nothing more than natural cycles of Earth, Sun, and galaxy that affect our state of being and our level of evolution. References in later literature show an even greater variety of belief about the time and place of the happier life, a variety which cannot be traced back to Hesiod or any other single source, but suggests an old and widespread tradition handled at different times and places and by different authors in many different ways. Further confirmation may be sought in the various parallels contained in Eastern literature, notably the Indo-Iranian myth in which Yima of the Zoroastrian Avesta and Yama of the Hindu Vedas must have had their common source, the story of a past age of happiness under a ruler who, when it ended, became lord of a paradise inhabited by the souls of the blessed. The Golden Age represented a paradise inhabited by the souls of the blessed. Baldry mentions a common source that we can trace all the Golden Age prophecies back to, namely the primordial Indo-Iranian myth, which gave rise to both Zoroastrianism and Hinduism. Both religions appear to be talking about the same hero king, the name slightly changed depending on which religion you look at. His name was Yima in Zoroastrianism and Yama in the Vedas. Zoroastrianism. We've already gotten a good look at the Hindu legends of the Golden Age in Part 1, but we haven't explored Zoroastrianism at all. The traditional Zoroastrianism website features an extremely comprehensive collection of research articles on the subject, and in History of the Ancient Aryans by Porus Hami Havewala, we find out more about this primordial Indo-Iranian civilization that later, probably much later, splintered off into Zoroastrianism and Hinduism. All the ancient Zoroastrian scriptures speak of an earlier homeland from where our people came, the lost Aryan Vayahi, or seedland of the Aryans. From this homeland, the Indo-Europeans, or Aryans, moved to Upper India, Iran, Russia, and the nations of Europe, such as Greece, Italy, Germany, France, Scandinavia, England, Scotland, and Ireland. The Vendidad is one of the ancient scriptures of the Zoroastrians. In the first Fargad, or chapter, the Golden Age of the ancient Aryans is outlined with their greatest king, Yima Ksheta, Yamraj in the Indian Vedas, who banished old age and death. Then the Ice Age broke on the ancient home, and the Aryans were forced to migrate southward, to the southeast and the southwest. Mr. Bal Gangadhar Tilak, a great Brahmin, Indian Aryan scholar of India in the last century, studied the Vedas and the Vendidad to find an ancient homeland of the Aryans. The Vedas are scriptures written by the Indo-Europeans, or Aryans, after they migrated to India. From the descriptions of the weather patterns mentioned in the Vedas, Tilak concluded that the ancient home must be in the Arctic regions, i.e. above present Russia. The Aryans migrated from the ancient home to Iran, and from there to India and Greece and Europe. Tilak also said that the most ancient historical scripture was the Iranian Vendidad, which actually describes the ancient homeland of the Aryans. The great 19th century Indian scholar Bal Gangadhar Tilak concluded that the Zoroastrian Vendidad was the most ancient historical scripture in the world. The name Zoroaster is actually a Greek pronunciation of Zarathustra, so both names refer to the same man. Zarathustra allegedly made contact with Ahura Mazda, the Zoroastrian equivalent of God. But according to the Vendidad, this was only a more recent reconnection. Zarathustra asked Ahura Mazda, "O Ahura Mazda, righteous creator of the corporeal world, who was the first person to whom you taught these teachings?" Then spoke Ahura Mazda, "Yima the Splendid, who watched over his subjects, O righteous Zarathustra. I first did teach the Aryan religion to him, prior to you." The author then describes the prior Golden Age in which there be neither cold wind nor hot wind, neither extreme winter or summer, and there be no sickness nor death, in which people are undying and unwanting, and gloriously happy. we then have a very interesting statement about time. In the first 1,000 years of his rule, Yima the Splendid enjoyed righteous order on his Aryan subjects. He controlled invisible time itself, making it so much large in size so as to praise and spread the righteous law. It is very interesting to speculate on what was meant by controlling invisible time itself. Given what we now know, this carries much more potential impact than most people may realize. Graham Hancock points out similar statements from Egyptian texts in his introduction to this book, that life is maintained by the progress and movement of time. And these words now sound very cutting edge. As the Vendidad continues, we have what appears to be a very clear description of the coming of the last major ice age. That glorious age of the Aryans did not last forever, O Zarathustra. It was time for the evil one's attack. I, who am Ahura Mazda, spoke then to Yima Ksheta. O splendid Yima, toward the sacred Aryan land will rush evil as a severe, fatal winter. Evil will rush as thick snowflakes falling in increased depth. From the three directions will wild and ferocious animals attack, arriving from the most dreadful sights. Before this winter, any snow that fell would melt and convey the water away. Now the snow will not melt, but will form the polar ice cap. Now there will be no footprints discernible at all on the packed sheets of hard ice that will form. Hence, the ancient Aryan civilization appears to have originated in what is now the frozen wasteland of northern Russia prior to the coming of the last great ice age. Given all the work of Graham Hancock and others, we can safely associate this with the time of the purported civilization of Atlantis. Boyce and Grenette's pioneering research. As soon as I read this, I wanted to know as much about the ancient prophecies inherited by Zoroaster as I could. This may be as close as we can get in our own historical record to the original teachings about what 2012 and the Golden Age really means. This brings us to Mary Boyce and Franz Grenette's epic scholarly work from 1991, A History of Zoroastrianism, Volume 3, Zoroastrianism Under Macedonian and Roman Rule. In it, considered among scholars to be the defining standard of all research into Zoroastrianism, we find out that some of the literary, archaeological, and numismatic coin evidence used to paint the picture of Zoroastrianism has only recently come to light. What I find interesting about this book is that the original Zoroastrian concepts about the end of the age do not have the apocalyptic quality that many other prophecies do. Zoroaster did not espouse the idea of human beings levitating up into the heavens and disappearing. Zoroaster's future expectations were fixed upon this loved and familiar earth. It is on it, restored to its original perfection, that the kingdom of Ahura Mazda is to come, and the blessed are to live here eternally in his presence, solid flesh, on solid ground. It was an end of history that he foretold, not an end of the world. On page 382, we get more detail about how this transition into the Golden Age is expected to take place. Namely, we see a progressive weakening of evil, thanks to the hard work of many people in exposing the truth. Prophecies of woes and iniquities in the last age are alien to Orthodox Zoroastrianism. For Zoroaster's fundamental message was that the triumph of goodness would come when evil had been progressively weakened through the concerted efforts of the just. Human virtues such as justice, faith, liberality, joyfulness will then be increasing throughout the world, and vices such as tyranny, enmity, heresy, and injustice will dwindle away. Zoroaster perceived the salvation of the world as dependent both on cosmic striving and on the sum of individual human choices. And these two conjoined aspects of his teachings, emphasis on individual responsibility and concern for the whole cosmos, made his doctrines strikingly relevant to the conditions and problems of the Hellenistic Age. Of course, the Hellenistic Age inherited these teachings, as did all other religions. That's one of the points that Boyce and Grinnett make so effectively. Everything traces back to the original seed of information and insight, and it appears that Zoroaster is the farthest back in time, and therefore the closest to the original essence of it. Very interesting context about the true nature of evil was revealed on page 443. Zoroastrianism taught that Ahura Mazda's rule over Earth in the beginning had been deliberately brief, since he wished for the invasion of his adversary, the evil spirit, so that he might defeat and annihilate him. This, of course, suggests that the real purpose of the negative forces are simply to help us evolve in consciousness, but they were never intended to win and never can win. They can only adapt to the basic nature of the universe itself, which is loving kindness. Fraso Kererti. On pages 427 to 428, we find out that time itself is expected to change by basically ceasing to exist as we now know it, once the Golden Age has arrived. This passage also speaks of a great judgment, which could obviously be disturbing to many people. And this may already represent how the original teachings were starting to get watered down and altered. Based on many other prophetic sources I have encountered, it appears that all this judgment really means is that we will be given a choice of whether we wish to continue reincarnating and learning the same lessons, or move into a state where we can pass through space-time and time-space with equal effectiveness, basically in an ascended form. If we don't decide to take the great invitation, we're not punished. We live our lives, pass away when it is normal and right, and continue moving through the growth opportunities that future lives in a physical body can give us. This passage is taken out of 2 Enoch in the old Zoroastrian scriptures. Before everything was, before all creation came to pass, the Lord established the eon of creation. Thereafter, he created all his creation, the visible and the invisible. After all that, he created man in his image. Then, for the sake of man, the Lord caused the eon to come forth and divided it into times and hours, when all the creation that was created by the Lord will come to an end, and every man will go to the great judgment of the Lord, then the times will perish. There will not be any more years or months or days. The hours will not be counted any more, but the eon will be one. And all the righteous that will escape the great judgment of the Lord will join the great eon, and at the same time the eon will join the righteous, and they will be eternal.